Or is that okay? Okay. Looks like it.
I notice this thing's rubbing a lot. I'm gonna actually put it up here. That way I'm not recording all that noise.
Sounds good. Do you want me to jump in? Okay. Dive in, as they say. Hi, everyone. My name's Ben White. I'm one of the physicians at Mass General in Boston. Was recently the director of clinical operations up there and have more recently taken on a new role as a director of a Center for Emergency Medicine Innovation. And I've been doing some work in observation medicine as well. And this is one of my favorite topics to lecture about. It's a bit of an odd scenario with all of you spread all throughout the room, but I'll try to make it as sort of interactive as possible. And just as a sort of brief introduction, my training is mostly in systems engineering and thinking about how to improve upon systems, especially systems of emergency care. But in the last 5-6 years or so, I've really gotten into this idea of the point of what we're doing being to really center on the patient. And when you think about the patient, obviously patient experience is front and center with that. But as I think you'll sort of see from these few slides that we're going to go through, there is a significant overlap between how the patients feel about their care and how we feel after we leave the shift that we just spent with them. And I hope to kind of bring that home to you guys a little bit so that you can get a little bit better of a sense for where patient, what used to be called satisfaction, now experience, relates to our experience as providers. So with that, if this would advance, not good at all, switch it up. How about that? There we go. So we're going to talk a little bit about the background here in terms of why one might care about the topic of patient experience. We're going to talk about a little bit of the evidence base for it and what the evidence can teach us about the topic of patient experience. And then we're going to go through the top 10 interventions, which is what the title of the lecture is, that you all might take back to your own shops and sort of think about applying today, tomorrow, the next day, probably next week, in terms of how to improve the experience of your patients. Of note, a lot of this overlaps really nicely with the way in which our departments have all changed in the setting of COVID and the COVID-related issues that we're all facing, and so just kind of keep an eye to that as well. And then this is the standard CME stuff that at the completion of this presentation, you all should be able to understand and appreciate the links between patient experience and excellent patient care to understand some of the factors that are related to improving patient and staff experience and to identify a few high-yield systems-based interventions that you might bring back to your own shops. So before I lose all of you, I do want to make a disclaimer. This is not about turning your emergency departments into the Ritz-Carlton. I think one of the main ways in which we have lost the fight towards thinking about patient experience is equating patient experience with customer service. That is not what we're talking about, right? There's a really great video with Darth Vader talking about emergency medicine and patient experience, or what was then patient satisfaction, saying, hey, look, if you didn't die, you should have great patient satisfaction, right? And tongue in cheek, But I think there's a significant sort of component of emergency medicine, which is doing the right thing medically. And we feel that if we've done that, we've achieved our goal, right? But my point here with this lecture and some of these slides is to allow you to think just a little bit more broadly about what we mean by quality healthcare and quality emergency care, and what we mean for ourselves when we leave the department and say, how did my shift go today? How do I feel about it? Am I burnt out, et cetera? So the patient experience landscape has changed a lot in the last decade as we've moved from calling it patient satisfaction to patient experience. And there is absolutely an increased and increasing focus in emergency medicine. We know from the literature that improving patient experience also improves the care that they receive. We know that it increases the compliance on behalf of the patients with the care plans that you give them, right, which is pretty important. We know that improving patient experience can improve staff satisfaction. We know it decreases provider burnout. We know that it reduces complaints, and vis-a-vis complaints also reduces malpractice risk. So there's a whole lot of reasons why patient experience is important, not just because of what it is for itself, but because of the ways in which it can help us. And then lastly, there's this thing out there called the EDPEC. How many folks have heard of it? Anyone? That is the typical response that I get when lecturing to groups about this, right? Nobody's even heard of this EDPEC thing, which stands for the ED Patient Experiences with Care Survey. And it is the HCAHPS for the emergency department. In fact, now it is actually called EDCAHPS. And so this is potentially something that's going to make us all care a whole lot more about patient experience, in that HCAHPS from CMS, from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, HCAHPS is tied to revenue generation. It is tied to how much money the hospital gets paid, right? And the ED Patient Experience of Care Survey, which has been under development since 2012, has recently been trademarked as the EDCAHPS survey. It remains voluntary at present, but who knows? That's what happened with HCAHPS too. It was voluntary to start, and then it became something that you had to collect and report on in terms of the data in order to get paid to do the job that you're doing, right? So to that extent, what is this, you know, EDPEC, now EDCAHPS survey? Well, it's, you know, 30 to 35 questions about the patient's experience, and now this clicker's not working. And it includes questions like, during this emergency room visit, did you get care within 30 minutes of getting to the emergency room? During this emergency room visit, how often did doctors listen carefully to you? Did the doctors and nurses try to reduce your pain? And again, a whole host of other questions. I'm not sure why we're having trouble here. And then, would you recommend this emergency room to your friends and family, right? So this is the typical patient experience question that you see on the Press-Ganey surveys, QDM, NRC. They all have this kind of summary question. And this is on the EDPEC, now EDCAHPS. So just know that at some point down the road, this whole sort of more broad discussion about patient experience may come to your emergency departments with a collection of dollars attached to it too. Again, it was only in March of 2020 that the trademark was granted. Right now, it's live, and also you can get it from CMS. It's in the public domain for free, so you can start practicing with it or thinking about it if you want. And then in addition to that, it's, like I said, voluntary, but most people who have seen the way HCAHPS went feel that this will probably be tied to reimbursement at some point. So the other thing that the literature has told us a little bit about is what is really important to patients, and how do patients look at their experiences with the emergency department. And not surprisingly, patient-staff communication, wait times, empathy, and compassion are much more important to patients than, for example, the ED environment of care, right? And that's worth thinking about because it gives us a sense of what it is that patients really want from an emergency department when they come see us. It also relates to the overlap conversation with burnout. So we all know that 48% of emergency physicians pre-COVID reported that they were burnt out, right? Which is a huge number. And if one of the main motivations for you all to think about patient experiences, to think about its relationship to burnout, that is totally reasonable because it is a real problem for us. And it is an issue that is not likely to go away without some thought and some action taken on our part. And I think the next lecture is actually, in large part, some of those topics. But just briefly to cover it, there is a collection of overlapping Venn diagram themes that relate both to the patient's experience and to your experience in the emergency department, including exhaustion, right? This is emotional exhaustion for staff, but it can also be emotional exhaustion on behalf of patients. Cynicism about whether or not the work that you're doing is valuable and whether or not the care that the patient is receiving is of value. And then inefficiency or inefficacy is a huge problem for all of us. And at least in our shop, has become even worse post-COVID, because during COVID, we had a sort of a mission, we had a plan, we had ways that we could battle this crisis, and now that we're mixing massive increases in volumes with a continued issue with dealing with patients that may or may not have COVID, it's been a really challenging time for ED efficacy, and the patients have felt it, and we've felt it as well. And when you bring all that together, you get this idea of, an overlapping Venn diagram of both the patient's experience and the staff's experience, and there's been some really interesting articles about it. And so for those of you that know of Tom Lee, he wrote a really interesting sort of summary of this kind of concept in which he calls patient experience and burnout flip sides of the same coin. There's a really interesting sort of description about the idea of thinking about burnout by promoting patient-centered care. And then in addition to that, this systematic review of their literature that was done in 2018 demonstrated some really interesting overlap between burnout, patient safety, and patient satisfaction, and how all of it kind of relates together. It's not rocket science, but it's worth just calling some attention to it because it gives us a sense that maybe there are some things within our circle of influence that we can spend some time and effort and energy on that will improve both our own sort of sense of meaningfulness at work and potentially even joy at work and the patient's experience with that care. So I already jumped ahead a little bit on this. Hopefully you guys don't remember all the details, but this is one of my favorite equations. So this is the equation for happiness. Has anybody seen this before? No one. Okay. So this is one of the sort of concepts that I think relates to so many things in life, but especially to patient experience, in that happiness equals reality minus expectation, all multiplied by perspective, right? So as your expectation of the TSA line increases, the reality matching it is not really a problem for you. As your expectation that you'll be upgraded to first class exists and then it's not met, your quotient is negative, right? And then that calls into question this whole idea of how much of sort of your attitude, your perspective, your view of what the world holds for you is something that you can sort of modify and change, right? And so I would suggest that when most of us decided to come to this conference and come to Hawaii, and this is my fourth time here, right, this is what I've sort of started to expect of my vacations in Hawaii. And this is why I brought my family this year, right? I brought my 7 and 9-year-old, ooh, don't tell my wife I did that, but my 7 and 9-year-old daughters and my wife out to this beautiful place to have that, right? And we were not at all expecting the Kona low that we experienced over the last 3 days. And for what it's worth, Kona lows happen once or twice a year out here, which I just recently learned. Whereas rain actually happens 113 days out of the year. So maybe we should have expected some significant rain, but not perhaps the Kona low. And so the point I'm making is that the last 3 days have really challenged our perspective and have led to some really interesting discussions about it, actually, in terms of like how do you manage to have a positive outlook on something even when the reality doesn't meet expectation? And how can you change your expectations to have them better meet reality and, in fact, at times be exceeded by reality? So with that example, I would ask you to just think for a minute about what you would expect as a patient going into an emergency department. So say you are out snorkeling on the reef, and because it's muddy, you cut yourself, and you've got a 3-centimeter laceration, and you have to go to the nearest emergency department. What would you expect when you got there? So now that you've had a few minutes to think about that, right? I would think that most of us would expect a clean and well-staffed ED that has a reasonably efficient care process, the ability to meet basic human needs, effective open lines of communication, and a kind, caring provider relationship, right? Basic things. But I would also suggest that even my own department, and I bet a lot of our departments, don't often provide all of that, right? And so one might reasonably align themselves with the patient to say, huh, your expectations were not met by reality, and thus I'm not all that surprised that you didn't have a great experience with our department. And this is not advancing. I'm going to go back up to the podium just so that this advances as well. And so if we agree, then, that the idea of expectations meeting reality are important, and that there is a possibility that we can both better manage expectations and improve the reality for our patients, how do we start doing that? And one of the best sort of frameworks that I've seen for this idea of an effort impact matrix, where basically you think about the things that you can do most rapidly with the least resources, and if those exist, those are a great place to apply some time and energy. And that's what this lecture, which is kind of the 101 level, is built on. It's 10 things that you can think about doing relatively soon with relatively few resources and relatively few meetings that are, you know, obviously a challenge at times when they become multidisciplinary. So the thought here is that you focus on the just do it side, the short-term, low-resource types of things. And then as we get to the end of the top 10 list, we're going to think about a little bit higher resource, perhaps a little bit higher length of time, higher effort types of interventions. So with that, we're going to move into the top 10. This is sort of a interactive type session in that the first picture that you're going to see is a clue. And if anybody wants to shout out the answer, I would encourage you to. I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a lot of shouting out because of the large room. But what's the first one? Clean. Pretty simple, right? So this is actually not rocket science again, but the idea that a clean, comfortable room like this improves the perception of care quality, it's pretty basic, right? But how many of us have dirty, cluttered, not so great looking care spaces for our patients, right? We certainly do. And we've tried for a decade to improve on that. And it just, you know, everybody puts things up. There's all kinds of sort of ways in which the stains don't leave, right? The you know, the stretchers hitting the walls, and you get these big chunks taken out of various parts of the you know, doorways, et cetera. It just starts to look terrible. And so to the extent that even just basic cleaning can help, it's worth considering. So one of the things that we've started is a deep cleaning system in which we have our environmental services on the overnights when they tend to be a little bit less busy. We have them pick one room and deep clean it, and they just go through all the rooms as a cycle, and then they start at the beginning and go through again. And it only shuts down one room, so as you're, you know, sort of building the airplane while you're flying it, you can just you know, lose a little bit less capacity. But it allows that one room to be really much more attractive when the environmental services group is done. Food. So we see 112,000 patients a year. And the answer up until 5 years ago for us was, hey, patients need to get their own food because we don't have a budget for that. And it really did not work out well, especially for our patients with acute psychiatric illness, for our patients who had very long lengths of stay, those that were waiting to have a disposition decision made. The first argument that we made was, look, if these patients are admitted and they're boarding in the department, they are admitted inpatients, they should be able to eat just like any other inpatient. That argument was fruitful. And then the next argument we made was, if these patients are here for 6-8 hours, I mean, who in their right mind doesn't normally eat within 6 to 8 hours? So we started with coupons, and then we moved to a basic list of things like granola bars and coffee and very simple, low-cost items. And now we've expanded our nourishment options to include multiple different sort of coupons for the cafeteria, et cetera, and a refrigerator that's stocked with sandwiches 24 hours a day. And it has made a huge difference for our patient population and frankly, for our nursing staff, because they now have something to offer to the patients that are hangry. And having a spouse who gets hangry, I can tell you it is a real thing. I have granola bars with me all the time, and it is a very helpful thing to be able to offer patients food. So to the extent that anybody in this room doesn't have some sort of a nourishment program, it is really worth thinking about getting one. And I use this example here as a vending machine in that we tried this as well pre-COVID. And patients will pay for their own food when they're hungry, right? And if you don't have a budget at all for anything else, most of these types of vending machines, they're companies that will come in, and because they make the money off the vending machine, it's cost-free. All you need is the space and a plug or a power outlet, right? So if that's the best that you can do, it's worth thinking about doing because really it has made a huge difference for us. It's not the kind of thing that we've been able to write up, though, so you won't see anything about it in the literature for a whole host of reasons, but it is absolutely a valuable intervention. Alcohol, so helpful, right? We've started giving out drinks in our department, and it's... No, I'm just kidding. So Dr. Sonas wouldn't be happy with me for that comment, but we have really made a big collection of sort of investments in improving patient comfort, especially with respect to the ways in which our department and the comfort of the department has changed in the setting of COVID. And little things go a long way, right? So warm blankets, right? And we've purchased a few extra blanket warmers of late so that they're closer to the care area, so it's not as long a walk, and that reduces the hassle bias to get a patient a warm blanket. Pillows had always been a challenge for us, and now we've moved to a different company so that our pillows are managed in a different way that's much lower cost. We have many more of them. Having just recently had a few days at the pool where it's been a little bit chilly, a few of those extra blankets, which are called towels out here, are really helpful, right? I mean, it absolutely changes the experience in the moment. So if there are ways that you can think about improving the patient's comfort, even if they're sitting within a COVID cubicle like ours are, it can make a big difference. And as an aside, the best thank you note I ever received about my care had very little to do with the care I provided, but the fact that I gave a mom and her daughter two warm blankets. And it is absolutely something that patients sort of can feel in terms of the nonverbal compassion that you're sharing with them. They get trickier as we go on. So that picture is not actually moving. And I would expect that most of you, when you look at it, think it's moving, right? Some of you have probably seen this optical illusion before. And it is here to sort of demonstrate the importance of perception, right? In that we all have varying perceptions of our environment, of the way in which we sort of feel at any given time, and how positive or negative anything is. But one of the best ways to change the perception of time is to distract the human brain. And there's really cool human systems engineering literature about this. But we have found that in the setting of our overcrowded emergency department, that really focusing on how to distract patients is incredibly helpful. There was actually a really interesting article about the difference between perceived wait time and actual wait time as well from about 12, 15 years ago now. And it all gets to this idea that if somebody has a distracting thing in front of them, they don't perceive time in the same way. Most patients have their own distractive device now, unlike 20 years ago when I started in this sort of field. Most patients have smartphones, even iPads, you know, something in front of them that they can use to distract themselves. And so we have installed these charging stations everywhere because a lot of patients' iPhone batteries don't last 6 or 8 or 10 hours. And so the charging stations have been really helpful, as has this idea of rearranging the seating in the waiting room, and this is something we took from the Massachusetts DMV, such that the seating is all facing a distractive device, which for us is a large flat screen TV. And it is a really effective way to, you know, kind of keep patients from focusing on each other and focusing on the amount of time that they're waiting and focusing on the fact that this patient went before this patient and all that kind of stuff. I will say, what I removed from this slide of late was the idea of books and magazines, and we had a volunteer group that would bring us magazines, which in the setting of COVID, we are not comfortable giving out anymore, and we didn't have enough for them to be sort of disposable. But to the extent that anybody might have the ability to do that, we've started handing out pamphlets about how our emergency department works, for example. Those are disposable. And all of those sort of areas of distraction are very helpful. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because I think it's worth mentioning here, too, that if you can develop a website for your emergency department that describes some of the things that patients care a lot about, we've created a frequently asked questions. We've created a sort of collection of resources that patients can tap into. And just recently, we've started texting patients as well about their stay, not quite at the Domino's pizza tracker level, but welcome to the emergency department. If you're interested, please watch this video. And the patients can go through their smartphone and watch a video about how their patient progression, their progression of care is likely to go in the emergency department. All really interesting ways to sort of think about distracting your patients. This one's pretty obvious. Treat pain, right? And I think there's another lecture coming up about this, so I won't get into any of those details, but we have a significant delay in the, at times, the space between a patient being triaged and a patient receiving care, specifically receiving orders for care, and that is a collection of details that I won't get into, but we have empowered our nursing staff that if a patient rates their pain on a scale of 9 or 10 out of 10, that they get treated like code sepsis, not quite like a code trauma or code MI, but you know they are. We are encouraging the nursing staff to make their care happen faster for them in a variety of ways. We've also gone through quite a lot of training with folks to say, look, you know, treating pain early, even if it's not the typical sort of way in which we used to treat pain early, which was just writing for 4 milligrams of morphine. Treating pain early with anything shares with the patient that you care about their discomfort and you're trying to ameliorate it. As you know, you can see from this article and multiple others, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it, it absolutely improves the patient's perception of both care quality and the sort of compassion of their provider. Speaking of compassion, this one is also a little tricky but obvious in some ways in that the idea is that any way that you can demonstrate compassion is incredibly helpful to improve patient experience. And the literature for this comes from all over the map. It's not just in emergency medicine. In fact, there isn't that much in emergency medicine. But in the psychiatry literature and in the sort of side of things that starts to be a little bit more related to business and customer service, there is quite a lot of sort of evidence about the importance of demonstrating to the person you're dealing with that you care about them, even if you can't meet their needs in the way they want them met, right? So instead of saying, I can't do an MRI for you, you can say something along the lines of, I wish I could perform an MRI on you, but unfortunately, our radiology service does not allow us to do MRIs on extremities, right? And the kind of language that we wrap around some of these interactions with patients makes a difference. In addition to that, as you can see by this model here, there are ways in which if you are interested personally or if you want your group to learn a little bit more about some of the components of demonstrating compassion that are natural to human beings when they think about them, this is a really good model. And this is from a psychiatrist whose name is Helen Reese. She's got an amazing YouTube video on it. It's 11 minutes, totally worth watching. But it just allows you to think about some of the ways in which the patient in front of you is perceiving your compassion and empathy or lack thereof. And, you know, I am absolutely guilty of not always making eye contact effectively with patients. And I certainly don't think about my posture that often. In fact, my posture is pretty terrible, right? But things like the tone of voice or giving the patient their period of time to state what they want to state and really like listening to them so that they feel that you're hearing them, and then considering your response. These are all ways to really sort of think about the emotion and the emoting of compassion that you're sharing with your patients. I guess the last thing I'll just say about this is having now watched a few videos about it, getting back to the burnout piece, it makes a huge difference for me to go into the room with that sense, even if I'm only going to be in the room for 2 or 3 minutes. And in addition to that, and this slide is not in this slide deck, sitting down absolutely changes the way patients perceive your interaction with them. So if you can get those rollable stools, and we bought 50 of them for our emergency department, that sit in the room and the provider can sit down, even if only for a couple minutes, the perception on the behalf of the patient is that you were in the room for like twice as long as you were, right? So these are not always things that increase the amount of time you have to spend in the room with a patient, but they can improve both the patient's perception of you as a provider and your feeling when you leave the room because the patient is in a different place. This is a related topic. So communication. So there are, in addition to thinking about empathy itself and the sort of way in which you emote with a patient and interact with them in a nonverbal way, there is the verbal aspect of communication. And we really like this iCare model. There's this other model called ADET that we haven't had as much success with. It ends with thanking the patient, which always feels a little weird to me, but some people do it. And the iCare model has a sense of, like, we kind of should be doing at least four of these things anyway, and it's not that complicated, right? So introductions, up until 3 years ago, I would probably miss introducing myself to a patient half the time because I would just walk in and either the PA was already in there or there was something going on or, for whatever reason, I would just forget to do it. And I worked really hard on scripting my introduction and doing it every time I walk into the room, even if it's interrupting something. And it has made a huge difference. It's also been called out now that we're using a new patient experience survey group. We use NRC now. It's been called out on many of the qualitative pieces of feedback that I've gotten for myself that I really appreciated that the doctor introduced himself with his full name and title. And it's so simple, and it takes 10 seconds. So if you're not currently introducing yourself, just consider trying it and see if it, changes anything for you. The idea of reassuring a patient regardless of what it is that they're there for, right, rather than necessarily promising things you can't promise, but just, trying to be a reassuring presence. Acknowledging pain. For us, it's often acknowledging long waits. There's an area of our department that I work in where the waits are usually 3 hours before I see the patient, 2 to 3 hours, and my script becomes, "Hi, my name's Dr. Ben White," or "Hi, my name's Ben White," depending on, the patient. And I say, "I'm the supervising physician here, and I'm really sorry for your wait. It seems like you've been here for at least this," right? And I know how long they've been here because of our Epic system. And it absolutely changes the way they interact with me because I've recognized their wait. And then the last two, for us especially, and we work in a pretty complicated system in terms of where patients can go from the time at which we interact with them, having a very clear sort of next steps review of care with the patients, and then making sure that they know that they have an opportunity to ask questions about those next steps has been really effective for us too. And given all of that sounds like it's going to take more time out of your day, if you don't want to do any of that right now, totally fine. Just consider putting up some signage that helps underscore what the patients are going to expect, right? And we now have 6 different signs posted all over the department. You can print them on these vinyl sheets that stick, so you don't need to make, sort of poster board signs anymore. You can print it on what they call adhesive vinyl. And it's super easy to sort of demonstrate to patients that you care about their being in the know and having a sense for what they should expect. And it also improves the sort of perception of the quality of care that they're going to receive and the sort of organized nature of that care. This is one of my favorite slides ever, which is why it's still in here from 2008. But this is a study from 2007. Oh, am I over time? Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay. In which basically 1.5 million patients demonstrated that if they're in the department for more than 4 hours, you've already lost the battle. This intervention is to finish strong, and the goal here is to think about the fact that 70 to 80% of your patients are going to be discharged, so consider how that process is going to work and make sure that it works really well so the patients feel like they had a good experience in your department and they ended on a positive note. And then the last one is to think about the fact that not all emergency care has to end at the point at which a patient was discharged, and so if you don't currently have a patient callback plan, it is worth considering starting one. This is on the side of being more costly and longer term, but can increase your the likelihood to recommend score by as much as 20% in this study. Sorry that I went over. In review, these are the 10 things that you can do to think about improving patient care and experience, and these are the things that you should take with you. There's an inexorable link between quality patient care and excellent patient experience. You can intervene on the most important causative factors, and improving patient experience can improve staff morale as well. Again, I'm sorry I went over.